This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 11th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to edition 288 of the Monocle Weekly in association with Persol here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, what happens when you play a game of telephone with an Andy Warhol piece in China? Artist duo Rob and Nick Carter are here to explain their latest project, Chinese Whispers.
Then we'll explore the gastronomic wonders in the latest edition of Where Chefs Eat. Its editor will explain why it's the only restaurant guide you'll ever need.
And later in the show, we'll go on a grand artistic journey through the places, stories and cultures of the post-Soviet states.
All that, plus our look ahead to the stories that are sure to set the news agenda during the week to come. That's coming up here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. And if you're a very good boy and you behave yourself, you get to present the Monocle Weekly at the end of the week, don't you, Andrew?
You certainly
Hello.
Do.
Welcome to the brand new year.
You're saying you've been a very good boy.
I'm an exceptionally good boy. and it's good. It's what do you think of the first week back in the office? I say week, I mean obviously 6 or 7 months, or how long it's actually been. Have you seen that Christian Bale movie, The Machinist?
I think everyone's struck by the same thing. It's actually quite hard going to work.
It's terrible, isn't it? So after Monday, it was like, we've got five more of things,
Yeah, I think I caught up with you at the end of Monday and you said, I just don't understand it. There was no port and cheese at 5 o'clock.
I know, it's really desperate. I know. I also can't really get into my head the idea that I'm not watching Kung Fu Panda 2 at 11 o'clock in the morning in my dressing gown. I'm hating not doing that. I mean, maybe I can do it. Maybe all I need to do is put some clothes on and come to the office. But the Kung Fu Panda bit, I suppose, is technically part of my repertoire. It's culture, isn't it? That's all right. I can get away with that.
I hear Paddington Bear's very good as well.
I've had quite an animated Christmas, actually.
Adults keep on telling me Paddington Bear's very good as well.
Yeah, I hear it's pretty good. I think it's cosy. Some cosy viewing.
Peruvian soft power. I'm sure Steve Bloomfield will get that into our survey.
it's all good stuff. Let's start, though, as we mean to go on with the new year, Andrew, by being chipper, bright, and by bringing Tom Edwards out of the news cupboard.
And when he's not on holiday in the Bahamas, skiing down the slopes of the French Alps, or drinking martinis in Hawaii, he's here. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Some mixed metaphors in that introduction, but never mind. Welcome, welcome to the new year, Tom Edwards.
Kind of the sounds of summer there. Yes. Yeah. Cheers you on a, you know, when it's kind of overcast here in London, isn't it?
Yeah, it does.
It's a cowboy in
Hawaiian
Hawaii
theme, yeah. I often get that. I prefer that introduction to the usual one where I'm just derided by Andrew Tuck.
That's a nice
way to.
I'm having a clean slate. I turned over a new leaf for this year.
That won't last long, I'm sure.
Don't start.
I'm joking. It's nice. It's nice to have you have the little kind of holiday season hiatus, and then but everyone's back. You know, back at the coal face. I rather like it.
Good. Right, seeing as you're so cheerful, start with your news review.
Let's begin. It's a preview. So huge stories really actually of the last week, which is kind of impossible to escape when looking ahead to next week, and that's of course, you know, events we saw last week in Paris. And one thing that's be interesting to sort of observe will be on Wednesday midweek when the scheduled next edition of Charlie Hebdo magazine is due to be published. And all the indications are that will go ahead indeed as planned, you know, not just as a show of defiance, but as a, you know, an honour to the memory of the journalists who were lost in those terrible events of last week. And I think it's very important to have that continuity to maintain that sort of sense of momentum, and obviously all of the surroundings event around that, you know, the next publication of that edition are going to be pregnant with all sorts of, you know, there'll be grief, there's all the kind of complex issues surrounding where France's national identity is, and I just think it'll be very interesting to chart how the magazine responds, how the public then reacts to that publication being back on the newsstands.
And it is the that's the wonderful, glorious failure of terrorism. Charlie Hebdo will probably never sell more issues ever. The world is more focused on what it had to say than ever before. The people who produced that magazine have become cultural heroes. So the terrorism has failed in that aspect. And I think that, you know, even just that is a remarkable thing.
Yeah, I think there's never a sort of a more complete failure than when, you know, communities, either where these awful events happen or around the world, as it, again in this case, are galvanised to respond. And, you know, I think it'll obviously be a very difficult day, but it should be something that's quite profoundly positive after, you know, what's been a, you know, incredibly complex and difficult time.
And none more sort of looked forward to of Infamous front page, presumably, in this coming edition.
Exactly. I mean, let's wait and see. One would imagine that there'd be a degree of restraint, but, you know, who knows? It'll be interesting to see what happens on Wednesday.
I do think that, you know, during last week, one of the most remarkable things has been the response of the cartoonists to, you know, this terrible attack, and just the humour and the wit and the dexterity with which they picked up their pencils within seconds and did something that was, you know, compelling and told the story better than, you know, perhaps any of the journalists covering the event.
Nothing cuts through, you know, difficult times or tragedies like humour, wit. You need to have that perspective. It's one of the things that enables people to get on with their lives all the time. You try and reflect with humour and a bit of wit and a bit of levity on everything, even the most awful things, because that's how you move forwards. I try and bring a bit of wit to the weekly news look ahead, but it's been rather somber.
It'll be all right.
Let's move on. Let's move on from, you know, the most difficult and appalling things to a bit of glitz, a bit of empty-headed fun. You know, the world of movies, Hollywood, you know, nothing could be further away from the difficulties of day to day than something that comes straight from, you know, the land of dreams, supposedly. And it's nominations week for, well, two awards, not just the Oscars, Rob, which is always much anticipated, but also the Razzies, my favourite, for the very worst in cinema.
Yep.
That actually is happening. That's happening before even the Oscars now, which I think is rather interesting. We celebrate the worst before even the best.
I know. And the worst thing is if someone gets nominated in both.
Well, there've been winners.
I suppose that's...
Apparently people are actually turning up now to claim their Razzies in person. It's extraordinary.
No, it's bad publicity, I suppose, right?
Yeah. It's like the Bad Sex Writing Award here in the UK, which has become a bit...
I suspect people are attempting to get into the show.
People like that award now.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. It's good. Do you have a hot nominee for the Razzies? Do you have someone that you would like to... Best actress, best actor, best director, maybe?
I've got a few for the Razzies. Well, the single most extraordinarily, apocalyptically awful film that I've seen in the last probably 12 months was The Guest. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that.
Dan Stevens playing a sort of returning American soldier who turns out to be a sort of mysterious
butler in the 1920s sitcom.
His transformation is dramatic from Downton Abbey, but the movie, unless it's a satire, if it's a satire, it's the best film I've seen.
He's an amazing actor.
But if it's a serious film, it's stunning. So that should be in there for my liking. Okay. It might even get an actual Oscar nomination. Imagine that, how far off the critical compass I am. But there we are.
Okay, so we've got the Razzies and the Oscars. It's an important week for that. Where are we going?
Yeah, well, let's do some kind of, you know, I like my sort of esoteric stories. What about one, Rob, I think for you, tomorrow, start of the Scottish salmon fishing season.
Oh, is it? Okay.
And did you know, this only happens Monday to Saturday. Did you know that, Andrew? You can't fish for salmon on Sundays. It's not allowed. How old school is that?
I think it's rather nice.
I think it's brilliant.
Give them a bit of peace and quiet, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Is that a religious thing?
I think so. It's prohibited by law on Sundays.
Very good.
Scottish law.
Isn't that interesting? But for the other 6 days a week, you can go absolutely hog wild, or salmon wild, as it would be, through till the 30th of November.
Yum. So it doesn't make me feel fairly hungry.
Get stuck in. Well, do you want to, if we're talking about food, elegantly done, midweek, this is ridiculous, but it's quite fun. The World Scotch Pie Championship begins.
What is a Scotch pie?
No, so it's a handheld pastry encrusted pie.
Filled with coins.
Well, traditionally minced mutton or lamb, but more commonly beef these days.
Okay.
And as with so much in life, it's all about the spicy seasoning as to who
I thought it was all about the base.
That's quite good. Very important, especially in a handheld pie, because if you get seafood, you could be scalded, for example.
Yeah. And these are the kind of pies that sort of rain down upon the players of Queen of the South.
Exactly.
Hamilton Academicals.
Exactly. Lower level
Scottish
football teams.
Yeah.
You're a football fan. Do you have one of these pies in of a weekend?
I am a fan of Tottenham Hotspur, and I don't think the club will mind if I even just get a scent of someone else eating one of the pies, I can be physically sick, so I don't go for it.
The catering at White Hart Lane leaves a lot to be
desired. It's one of the most repugnant things.
Surely if they're at White Hart Lane, it should be a venison pie.
It should be incredibly high end. But they're obviously trying to make sure that we still get the authentic early 80s football experience. Okay, serving up inedible awfulness.
Okay, it's a bit more...
Challenge me if I'm wrong.
It's a bit more Seven Sisters than it is...
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Nice. Do we have anything else on the news menu?
One last one. This is from starting next weekend. You know, I'm slightly obsessed with pigeons. I've probably talked about this before.
People are either obsessed by pigeons or not. Who's slightly obsessed by pigeons?
No, because for example, I don't have my own loft of pigeons, you know, on top of my house. But that's not a bad shout, actually.
They're very bad for your respiratory system. They're very dusty animals.
Is that true?
If you swallow one whole.
Yeah, exactly. Putting out the feathers like Sylvester the cat.
You're supposed to pluck them before you cook them and eat them, Rob. But yeah, it's the British Homing World Homing Pigeon sort of event is taking place in Blackpool.
Okay.
Of course.
Yeah.
One of the largest in the world, 25,000 people will go. It's the Crufts of the pigeon world, Rob, I'm reassured. 2,500 pigeons on display vying to be crowned supreme champion.
Where do they fly to and from if they're in Blackpool? Because it's quite a big thing for them to go across the channel and back again. That's quite a sort of test of how good the homing pigeon is.
Well, you think back to
where do they go if they're in
Blackpool? I think they might be on display. So this is, you know, maybe there's a little sort of panel with their achievements listed. Okay. And you can read about their endeavours.
Okay. If they're lucky, they can go to Cleethorpes.
So it's like an it's like an exhibition match.
Off the tower, they have to fly. But pigeon fanciers of the world, there are lots of celebrity. You know, Mike Tyson, of course, a noted pigeon fancier.
Is he really?
Very, very, you know, obsessive.
Okay.
Maybe he'll be in Blackpool.
Maybe he will be. Don't tell Sky Sports, because they'll make their own channel for
this. I think
that's
probably on already.
Yeah, they love a channel for niche sports. Talking of which, did you enjoy the darts over the festive period? I feel that you might be a darts...
I love the darts.
...secret darts aficionado.
I love the darts. I love the attitude of the crowd following the darts. There's nothing better. It takes fancy dress to a whole new level, that's for sure.
It certainly does. It takes sport to a whole new level.
Yeah, a level down.
You're right there. Tom Edwards, what a wonderful New Year news look ahead. Thank you very much indeed. We start today with the artistic equivalent of a game of telephone. Our first guest, the artist duo Rob and Nick Carter, wonder what would happen if they sent works of Andy Warhol to professional artists in China, asking them to replicate what they saw and then to send their version to another studio and do the same.
Well, the results of the project are featured in a new solo exhibition opening here in London on the 14th of January. The show's called Chinese Whispers, and I'm pleased to say Rob and Nick join us here in the studio. Nick, let's start with you. Where did the initial idea for this come from? It's a glorious thing to see, and we'll talk about some of the images in a moment, but what was the starting point for you?
The seed of the idea came from a series of work that we did transforming old and modern masters. We've always looked back at art of the past, and it's informed our working practice. It's hard to say exactly when the idea struck us.
I mean, it's a great one-liner, isn't it, as well? Everyone, I mean, it's taking an idea for a walk, isn't it? It's a lovely idea.
Exactly.
It's a lovely sort of explainable idea.
Exactly. We were toying with ideas. We did some experiments with Picasso drawings, and the results we were really pleased with. But then we moved on to Warhol because we thought he'd such a prolific artist with all the drawings that he'd done. And we actually went out to Chanzeng in China and visited the studios, the copyist studios, and started with some paintings and then moved to drawings. And we're really pleased with the results.
And Rob, I wondered the idea of going to China. We have a perception, right or wrong. You'll be talking here about these studios that copy. China's, you know, accused or not accused of being copyists and making perfect versions of everything. Here there's we'll talk about the images in a moment. They're not perfect versions. Was there some playfulness around investigating this perception of Chinese art and Chinese commercial art in this sense as well?
Well, it was very interesting, actually, when we first went to Shenzhen, to one of these so-called painting villages. They're not painting villages at all, really. They're 40, 50 stories high, and there are people working in very cramped conditions, perhaps painting four or five Van Gogh sunflowers every day. And when we first arrived, you know, the copies are pretty good. You know, they're very, very prolific. There's a new hotel opening every day in China at the moment, and they will phone up these painting villages and make their order for the unique, in inverted commas, paintings for their bedrooms and bars and so forth. And the copies are actually very good. And we did think on arrival that this idea might not work. We might end up with 30 identical drawings. But as we found out, when they're taken out of their comfort zone slightly, because each one of these artists will specialize in one or two particular paintings, and a lot of these Warhol drawings are lesser known from earlier on in his career, from 1942 onwards. And when they're asked to copy a drawing that they're not familiar with, it is actually very difficult. You know, they're very hands-on. They don't use projectors. They don't trace. And it was very interesting to set the wheels in motion and just to see how it evolved over time.
A couple of my favourites from the book that you just presented this with, guys, are the drawing of Mick Jagger, which starts off as a youthful Mick Jagger. I suppose an early 70s Mick Jagger he is. And ends up, man, he ends up looking like the punchline to that George Melly joke about lines on Mick Jagger's face. This is an amazing thing to go from looking like the prima ballerina of rock stars to W.H. Auden. This must be one of the ones where you kind of, it comes out the other end and you're like, yes, our idea worked brilliantly.
Well, do you know what? We see them. They send first of all, we pick the images, which is a really kind of a tricky thing to do. Images that we think might change well over time. And they send us JPEGs every twice a week, you know, when new copies come through, and we see these JPEGs, but we're unable to do anything about them. We can't control it. Once we've set the wheels in motion, what will be, and we have to wait until the end of the process to see the final picture when all 30 artists work
you don't get all the gradations through the weeks.
No, we get photos of the drawings step by step, and after 15 weeks, I think it is, then we can see them all and see how it's changed, but we can't instruct them in any way to go back and just change his eye a little bit. You know, if artist number two misses a stroke out, then that is missed out for the duration of the piece. And that's quite exciting too, as an artist, to set the wheels in motion and just let things unfold.
And Nick, when you've looked at the pictures, do you feel that those changes happen because people aren't very good? Or I often wondered when I looked at the images, whether it was actually because people had a bit of an artistic kind of inner kind of thought that they weren't normally able to express, and they suddenly became a little bit creative when they did their version. That's how the changes happened.
Do you know, I think it's like it's a visual Chinese whisper, and I don't think they're conscious of the changes they're making as such. They are copying, literally copying the previous copy. And if you isolate two images next to each other, you realise incrementally there's tiny, tiny, tiny changes. But then once that's spun out, by number 30, it becomes a massive change.
We did have quite an interesting time. The first time we set it off, as Nikki was saying, we started with some Picasso drawings, the single line drawings of animals that he did. And we were getting sent these JPEGs and we couldn't quite work out. They clearly hadn't been copying from the previous drawings. And so we questioned them about this and they said, oh no, we're not copying, we're improving. In a very kind of Chinese sort of way. We're taking your Picasso drawing and making it better. Yeah. So it took them a little while to really get the gist of what we're doing. And what's quite important is that the 30 artists are working independently. So no two artists know kind of what's going on. They're just given a pile of 20 or so drawings from the previous artists and told to just copy them one by one.
I was going to, on Picasso, there's Man Looking Right, which is one of Warhol's original drawings, starts off looking like a good cartoony, you know, pen sketch by Warhol, and ends up like a Picasso. Wow. Interesting. It does end up like a cubist thing. It's an amazing thing, yeah.
I mean, the Andy Warhol Foundation really embraced the idea of these copies, which was fantastic. But as you say, in that particular piece, they're colouring in by the end of it.
Yeah,
and once they start colouring in, then it becomes pretty much, some of them are very black drawings.
I love having conversations with actual serious artists where we can use the word colouring in. I think that's refreshing.
Nothing wrong with a
bit of colouring in.
We were talking earlier also about the one that's the outline of the United States of America, which starts off, you know, as the outline of the United States of America or the Americas. And by the end, it's become a series of very nice sweeps and curves and dots as well. They're breaking down into something that's purely graphic. Not, it doesn't seem to be a map anymore, but beautiful as well by the end. Nick, did you quite like the journey some of these pictures went on then?
Yeah, we were elated when we were getting them back. I mean, maybe that's what the world will look like after a bit of global warming. Who knows? or maybe it looked like that before. But
I think there's a Chinese habit of redrawing maps, I think, right?
What was most interesting in some ways was the pieces that contained writing, that because those artists that were copying the works didn't actually use English, you know, didn't write English tools. It ends up looking like Mandarin, a lot of the script, certainly on the Coke cans and so forth.
And the Coke can, again, is another interesting one. It starts as a great sort of icon of Americanism and consumerism and ends up as, it looks like a sort of, again, it's a, like a load of rubbish. It looks like a, it's strange, isn't it?
Well, some of the figures actually look like they've been written in Mandarin.
And that's amazing. And Andrew mentioned the idea of Chinese mass production and also the idea of copying, you know, copying other nations' inventions and this sort of thing, which is a slightly political thing. The art historical thing is interesting. Did you choose Warhol over Picasso in the end because of this idea of endless reproduction of his silk screens, of the idea of the Brillo boxes and the soup cans?
Exactly. And one of his quotes, which isn't life a series of images that evolve as they change. And I think that's as they repeat themselves. And I think that was that was something that really struck a chord.
But also the end results are very Warholian. Grid formats, each one slightly different. And it's the way he worked in his screen prints and in various other things. There's a show on at the moment in the Tate Liverpool where one of Warhol's Xerox series is on show, and it's Chairman Mao been copied 300 times on a Xerox machine, but Warhol chose to just enlarge by 0.1% every time he re-photocopied it.
Yeah.
And so that ends up as a very large grid and becomes abstracted as it gets larger, and you don't really work out what it is by the end of it. Which is similar to these, I guess.
And it seems like a bit of an obvious question asked after we've kind of inspected these pictures. But did they turn out as you thought, or how far apart you thought the beginning and the end were going to be in each of these pictures?
I mean, I got to be honest. I thought they were going to be much more similar. The top left to the bottom right. The amount of change in some of them is really quite extraordinary. But as Nikki said, if you isolate two pictures side by side, the 17th and 18th, for example, there's not much between them. But between the first and the 30th, there's a huge change, which has been very surprising.
And were you able to recognise, out of all the artists that took part in the project, who had the skill and who was just, you know, the skill at being a great copyist, that is?
I'd love to say yes, but...
Yeah, you could.
We did meet a few of them, but sadly we don't know who did which image.
Maybe we should have got them to sign the back.
Yeah, right. That's the thing.
I mean, we've labelled them 30 drawings by 30 different artists. It would have been nice maybe to
list the names.
But we're sending out a book to the Painting Village, and hopefully they will have a look and pick out the ones that they recognise that they've drawn.
And the exhibition is a selling exhibition? People can be able to buy these works? And are you selling editions of the editions of the editions? Or
no,
how does that work?
They're all unique works. So the drawings are...
They're each slightly the same.
So one work is framed, 30 drawings all window mounted within one frame, and all those drawings are the actual drawings on which, you know, the artist put pen to paper, and that's a unique work that's framed up and hanging in the gallery. So the book contains all 66 unique works, and we'll be showing around 25 of them in the gallery.
Nice. And that gallery is the Fine Arts Society. And the show is on from the 14th to 29th of Jan. The artists, Rob and Nick Carton, have it on their very good authority that there is nothing wrong with a good bit of colouring in. Thank you both very much
thank
for coming
you.
In.
Thank you.
Time for a little music now, we hope related to the theme that we were just thinking about. This is Aussie band Cut Copy with Far Away. That was Far Away by Cut Copy.
As Design Miami celebrated its 10th anniversary this year, Monocle Films explored new themes in the collectible design market.
I think that we're beginning to become more of a design-driven culture as we learn to consume more responsibly. We're beginning to learn that better design helps us actually live better. And I think America's finally waking up to that fact.
Pull up a chair to watch Design Miami 2014, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
Our next guest is here with all the restaurant recommendations you could ever need. Where Chefs Eat, published by Fiden, is an international guide made up of recommendations not from bloggers or foodies, but from globally renowned chefs themselves. More than 600 of them.
A brand new version of the guide is out in February. Joe Warwick is the editor, and he joins us in the studio now. A huge beast of a book. Now, there's so many restaurant guides out there, you know, tipped by people who are chefs, people who are food critics, crowdsourced ones. Why did you think that it was a good idea to go and ask chefs where they would recommend for us to eat?
I'm trying to put all restaurant critics out of a job, myself included. I think the idea for it started, I was lucky enough to get El Bulli when it was still open, and they had this list of restaurants that they'd give every guest to go there. It was a pilgrimage to go there. But obviously, you wouldn't just go for that meal, or maybe you would if you had a Learjet. I don't know. But, you know, people would usually go to Barcelona for a weekend. They'd make going to the restaurant part of it, and then they'd have other places to go. And El Bulli used to give out this list, this three type sheets with, you know, a list of other places to go to. And I remember thinking that was a really good idea. And I kind of thought, you know, other restaurants must have this, you know, particularly when you go to these restaurants, ones are in the world's 50 best restaurants, ones that are a pilgrimage. There's other places you want to go, and you maybe only want to do one of those meals, but then you want to go for breakfast, you want to go for a casual lunch, you want to go for somewhere late at night. And yeah, that was kind of where the idea came
from. But when you asked them to start putting together the list, I would imagine the danger is that chefs would probably or say go to, you know, it's closed now, but go to El Bulli, that they would want to show off a bit and kind of send you to places that are all foam and fancy. Are they very good at actually saying, here's a good place for, you know, the ultimate beef burger or et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, well, I mean, what we did, so again, I was involved in the world's 50 best restaurants originally as well. So I wanted to get away from that. I wanted to get away from those very high-end places that, you know, you couldn't get into, that it was hard to get a reservation for. So we surveyed them and we asked them to pick places for breakfast, to pick places for late at night, to pick places that, you know, bargain places. And so you kind of forced them to make those decisions. And actually, chefs are fantastic at picking late night restaurants. It shouldn't surprise, because they're not so good at breakfast, not so good at breakfast. And interestingly, we've got a category there, the place, you know, wish you opened yourself. And that tended to be those 50 best places, yeah. those fancy, foamy places. But beyond that, most of the restaurants we've got aren't those kind of places. I mean, we've got hot dog stands, we've got burger bars, we've got, you know, little tapas bars, places in the middle of the nowhere that you probably wouldn't have thought of going to. And I think chefs actually, the fancier the restaurant that they work in, when it comes to their downtime, they actually want something completely opposite. And so I think they're very good at finding burger, finding ramen, finding, you know, the scruffy little Chinese place. They're good at that.
And this is presumably what we need. This is the kind of the opposite of the crowdsourcing. This is, I mean, it's obviously, you know, it's a word from on high. It's these renowned chefs kind of telling you where they would go. Did people always want to tell you about the scruffy little Chinese place for fear that it would change into an unscruffy one? Do you know what I mean? Whether it suddenly get some airs and graces?
I suppose there is a little bit of fear of that. I mean, we are doing crowdsourcing, but we're crowdsourcing from a professional audience. Yeah, I think there's probably, I know there's a couple of places that have probably been held back for that reason. Yeah. You know, I found out, but I think they've been pretty good about it, and I don't think that crossed their minds, but yeah. And sometimes, but it does go to people's
heads.
Because
it's a bit like, you know, the world of something like social media, where in the sense that, you know, I wonder how many people ended up realizing that they had like friends in common or a place in common, that were there restaurants that suddenly popped up in all sorts of people's lists that in a way they probably all thought were secret as well.
There was a place in Sydney in the first edition called Golden Century Seafood that, you know, seems to be every single chef that works in Sydney and every chef that visits Sydney goes to, and that's become a huge thing. The ones that tended to get lots of recommendations would be the ones you expected, be your Nomas and places like that. You know, somewhere like in London, somewhere like the Wolseley, you wouldn't think would be incredibly popular, but amongst chefs, but it's like every chef, it's the most popular breakfast venue of all the people.
It's open late, and I suppose it also, chefs are business, chefs, if they're not business people they want to be, probably.
Yeah.
And people admire a well-oiled machine like
completely. And it's a great, it's a great, it's a great place to go for breakfast.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Even if it's the night before.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also the way that it's set out. Obviously, it's I think it's done internationally, right? In terms of yeah. parts of the world, and then cities in terms of those parts of the world and all the rest of it. There's obviously a kind of usefulness to it, despite the fact it's a bit phone directory-ish.
Yeah. I mean, that was.
But
the
also,
idea.
I should say to potential buyers, coffee table-tastic too.
Yeah, I mean, it's about the, well, this one's actually slightly bigger than a concise Oxford dictionary. And I think, you know, the idea with the book is you'll be flicking through it at home at your desk. And then, of course, there's an app as well, which in terms of being a traveller is a much,
save
more,
our lives, yeah.
Yeah, a much more useful thing, because you can get the whole book on there. And it does all sorts of clever things with location services and things like that.
I'm just having a look through the London section, which is good. So there's, you know, there's everything from Meat Liquor that we've had the guys on from there quite a few times. That's yeah. You know, a burger place. What's quite nice is they also choose places like Bill Granger's restaurant, which in a way is a popular kind of chefy restaurant, but isn't yeah. like the chefiest of chefiest restaurants. So it's quite nice that all of those things end up in the mix.
Yeah, well, I mean, chefs are people too.
Yeah.
And they've got different tastes, and some of them like, you know, very off the beaten track places, and some of them like more mainstream places. And I think all of their opinions are valid, really.
Now, you obviously were involved with the 50 Best Restaurants before, but the drift of food and the people that we see coming through here, you know, we don't present the food show, but on this show we've met great food producers, people making, you know, gin in the middle of London. There seems to be a drift around the world in a nice direction, which is about heartier ingredients, things made in the city, a bit more honesty and integrity about around our food. And did that seem to be a theme that popped up in lots of the places that were being recommended around the world? Did you see any global trends coming forth in what chefs were choosing?
I don't think there's a global... I mean, I think the restaurant scene, you know, around the world is improving, certainly in terms of, you know, accessible democratic dining. And yeah, that's reflected in the choices there. I think people say overall themes. I think chefs do crave informality and laid back places and fun places when they go out. And they will go to those other high-end restaurants to check out what their peers are doing or to go and see a friend. But really, they're craving informality. And I think that's definitely a trend. I think fine dining is dying. It's on its last legs. And the fine dining we do have, a terrible term, but the fine dining we do have in places like Noma is completely different to what it was 10 years ago. You know, tablecloths are gone. The service is a lot more friendly. It's less stiff. And I think, yeah, that comes across definitely in their choices.
There is a thing. I mean, obviously, presumably reading this book can tell us about food trends as well. I mean, you know, in broad terms. I wonder when we talk about fine dining, you'll know this better than I do. I always feel that maybe fine dining is dead in that kind of very stuffy way that we maybe think about it. But it's kind of nice to have a napkin, an actual linen napkin. It's nice to have a waiter that knows how to do his job. I kind of felt that we were sort of getting fed up with like eating burgers off bricks.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at, you know, my favourite place of mine that's opened in London in the last year is a place called Lyle's. Chef was at St. John Bread and Wine before, and he's very into the kind of Danish Nordic scene. And if you look at what's going on, it's a case of it's affordable, but it's clever. There's that attention to detail in the ingredients. There mightn't be a tablecloth. There's not a lot of fanciness there, but it's still high quality. And I think, yeah, that's coming across. Those places with ridiculous Bibles for wine lists and, you know, waiters to help waiters and lots of silver stuff. There'll still be a few of them. There's always going to be a few of them. But the new ambitious restaurants that are doing a fine dining thing, and we've got to come up with another word for another term for fine dining. I hate it every time I say it; it makes me shudder. But that are doing that kind of thing are doing it in a modern way, and I'd say it's been led by what's going on in Denmark and wider in Scandinavia.
And there's a refreshing lack of ego to the way that this book is put together. Each description of the restaurant is kind of short and succinct. No one's kind of showing off with verbal pyrotechnics. I guess that you're letting the chefs do the cooking, and less of the talking.
I mean, what we wanted, and I think we've got it 90%, we wanted a quote from each chef for every restaurant. We've almost got that, because they're their choices. They're not my choices. There's places in there that I maybe would have put in that aren't in there. But
you've got Cairns here on Westbourne Grove.
Yeah. I love Cairns.
Although
on
I'm
Westbourne
very sad
Grove.
It's lost its booze license. It was a long time ago, but there you go. Who,
last time
who
I was
wants
there
a mocktail, really? They're butter chicken.
Last time I was there, I saw two waiters having a fight, actually. It was a while back. But But yeah, it's their choices. Yeah. It's curated by the chefs, and I'm just keeping an eye on it and putting it together for them.
Well, I should ask you this $64 million question then, Joe, which is, which one do you wish you'd opened?
Which one do I wish I'd opened? I mean, St. John, I think, is again, insanely popular choice with not just British chefs, but for chefs around the world. I think there's something special about that place. So, yeah. Probably there.
So for people who don't know, this is nose to tail eating.
It's Fergus Henderson's place. Yeah,
yeah. Certainly here in the UK, the first place to really kind of champion that return to kind of thinking, actually, if you're going to kill an animal, you might as well eat the whole thing, please.
But also the aesthetics of the place, you know, it's in this old smokehouse, it's all white, it's very simple, it's, you know, it's not a cheap place, it's definitely not, but it's incredibly accessible, and you can go in and have a Welsh rare bit, or you can go in and spend an awful lot of money on dinner.
An awful lot of money.
An awful Hooray! Lot of money. Yeah, unintentional pun there. Excellent. I think that's great. And if you look at the influence that that's had on restaurants that have opened in London, places like, you know, Hereford Road, and I was talking about Lyle's guy used to work there, Anchor and Hope, you know, there's a whole list of places that wouldn't be the way they are without St. John. And then if you go to New York, places like Prune, I think that place is combination of being incredibly influential and a lot of fun and still relevant 20 years later. You know, which is not easy to do for a restaurant.
Well, let's nick this and go out for a hearty Sunday lunch after this, Andrew. That was Joe Warwick, editor of the latest edition of Where Chefs Eat, a guide to chefs' favourite restaurants.
After the break, we take a tour of the people, places and cultures of the post-Soviet states. Stay tuned.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
In a moment of political turbulence and increased tensions between the East and West, the significance of anything that creates mutual understanding gets emphasised, art included.
International art organisation Dash Arts tries to create artistic experiences that change the way we see the world. And at the same time, it brings artists together from different parts of the world.
Dash Arts projects tend to be ambitious, and the latest one delves deep into the culture of former Soviet states. To hear more, I sat down a bit earlier with Josephine Burton, one of the co-founders and artistic directors of Dash. Josephine, welcome to The Weekly.
Thank you.
And let's give our listeners a bit of a crash course. That's easy for me to say, in Dash Arts. It's obviously, you're a bit of a roving arts project that, well, has got some interesting successes under your belt, right?
Do you want me to tell you about us?
I want you to tell us all about it.
So
yeah.
I set up my organisation Dash Arts with my colleague and co-director, Tim Supple, about 10 years ago, just under 10 years ago. And Tim is a theatre director by background, and he's directed shows at places like the Young Vic and the National Theatre and the Barbican. And my background is actually originally as a singer and subsequently more as a music producer. And we came together to make work with artists abroad that would be deliberately cross art form, that would be under one umbrella, have a big show of contemporary theatre and dance and music under one separate productions under one house that would all in some way be linked through a focus, a theme.
There's an idea of positivity about lots of these things. I know that you did a sort of North African or an Arabic focused series of works. We're going to go on to your post-Soviet thing in a second, which is the reason you're here to talk about that post-Soviet thing. But there's an idea presumably of getting people to talk, work together and kind of dish out ideas for each other, artistic ideas to each other that wouldn't maybe necessarily talk, and genres that don't necessarily cross-pollinate. I suppose that's part and parcel of it, is it?
That is exactly. Well, our strapline is changing the way people see the world, which could sound a bit do-goody. But the idea is that we're on a journey to try to understand other people, other cultures, other countries, other worlds, and digest that understanding into some stellar, brilliant, international, high quality shows that are and themselves brilliant and commendable and wonderful, and yet underneath it also perhaps have something else, some added value of, I don't know, just a kind of a glimmer of an idea that might inspire new thoughts and new directions for people.
And Post-Soviet is your next thing. Where did the idea for that come from?
Well, we are generally, as well as being interested in creating wonderful work, we're interested in otherness, Tim and I, in our own different ways, quite different ways. And my way is often to bring musicians together from different backgrounds and get them in a room together making work and see what comes of it. And as you referred to earlier, we were recently working in the Arabic world, and of course the Arabic region has for the last, well, for many, many time eternal years, been a kind of an other. But obviously since 9/11, it's very much been a very kind of upfront other. So we were keen to go deeper into that world and perhaps to show a richer, more textured understanding of a world that people may see as just the other, the enemy, the world behind a curtain. And of course, the big iron curtain was the Soviet world, which for so many years was the great other. And so that was part of our journey, was to try to investigate and understand that whole post-Soviet world, which isn't just Russia. It's the Caucasus and Moldova, Belarus, Ukraine, and further east into Central Asia. But also, of course, that part of the world is so culturally rich and vibrant, the literature, the music. So much of the 20th century kind of musical, artistic, theatrical, literary journey began earlier, in a pre-Soviet world in that region. So that artistically was very inspiring for us, as well as obviously politically kind of extraordinary. And I will go on to say that when we began it a few years ago, everyone said, "Yeah, I understand why it's sort of interesting." And obviously, it was highly, the Soviet Union was a highly significant part of our upbringing, but the shadow of it. But that's 20 years ago, and why now? And people aren't saying that anymore. What's, you know, over the last year with the sort of the chaos that's erupted in Ukraine, and with Putin sort of asserting himself as trying to change the geopolitical dynamics in his own way over the last couple of years, the post-Soviet states and the issues that they bring feel very relevant and important now.
And we can't not therefore touch on the politics. Yeah. Was it the politics? Was it the idea? Was it the Sovietization of these independent countries that stifled their creativity? Was there an outpouring of creativity? Do you see an outpouring of creativity either in opposition to the sort of czarist idea of Putin's regime in Russia? Or are there some good news stories? Are people making really good pop music, for example, something that's very, very obviously accessible? Or is the art that we're talking about politically engaged? Perhaps it needs people like you to make a portal for people to walk through to find it accessible.
I came to this project thinking I was really interested in looking at the post-Soviet experience. And I'm, for example, creating a project with classically trained musicians who in the post-Soviet world have been unable, perhaps for financial reasons or possibly for political reasons, being able to remain in the classical music world, have gone on a big musical artistic journey out of traditional classical music into rock or pop or jazz or electronica. And it was definitely the case that I thought that there were lots of opportunities that arose in a post-Soviet world where suddenly you could hear music that you couldn't hear before because of politics. Or there was opportunities to play it live when they hadn't been able to play it live. And so I thought perhaps there'd been this great flourishing of music. And I'm talking very specifically about music in the last 20 years. But it's not that simple. I think often when I'm there, I hear people saying, but actually people are interested in money now in a way that under the Soviet Union they weren't. They were just interested in good art. And actually all the great art is sort of no longer here because it's all become really commercial and dull. And then I would hear people saying, there was amazing jazz in the late 80s in St. Petersburg. It was the most extraordinary jazz scene ever. And it's not like that anymore. So I think it is quite complicated. I mean, I think in it, coming back to your question about politics, there are some extraordinary artists, both in Russia and in the other post-Soviet countries, encountering and engaging politically with ideas, whether it's in literature, in plays, in music, in visual art, a lot of extraordinary visual art. Soviet Union sort of, the Soviet approach, and possibly even before that time, kind of prevented politics being so sort of publicly, you weren't outspoken, everything was sort of hidden, it was in allegory, it was sort of presented underneath all sorts of things through a King Lear that perhaps attacked the attack King Lear in a way that it was King Lear became Stalin. That's a very crass example. But actually, there's never really been a big tradition of political art. And so, and apart from, you know, and so I think people like Pussy Riot, for example, and this more recent contemporary art scene that has emerged is quite radical and quite unusual.
There's obviously some heavy ideas at play here, whether it's in Russia or whether it's in any of the other former Soviet states. Does this part of the world have a good sense of humour when it comes to its art, whether it's its pop music, its visual art, its theatre? Because there's a heaviosity that ensues when we talk about these big issues. How funny and how light can people be when they're kind of regarding their last, you know, 50 years of turmoil, perhaps?
I think there is a wry smile throughout. In fact, we, as well as doing these big shows at Dash, we present small events in London every month, which we call Dash Cafes. It's sort of pop-up events, little windows into the world that we're working in with sort of outtakes of our research. And about a year ago, we did an event called The Hammer and the Tickle. The Hammer and Tickle title, which is a brilliant title, came from a wonderful writer called Ben Lewis. Oh, I just remembered his name. Ben Lewis, who wrote a book about humour in the Soviet Union. And it was richly lovely. And we pieced together an event which showed lots of great footage and great jokes. And they're amazing jokes. So, yes, humour is there. But there's a lot of sort of seriousness. The plays are generally quite serious and, you know, heavy.
And are you looking to sort of inject a little bit of, I mean, maybe it's a Western idea, but are you looking to make it accessible, or are you looking to perhaps change people's the art of the former Soviet states and present it in your frame, or are you trying simply to present it?
The work that we create at Dash is very much channeled through our creative process. And so we bring together these artists and with them make shows, but it's very much led by our own interests, our own passions and our own direction. We're not, sadly, not very commercial. Sometimes we are. I made Summer Night's Dream that my colleague Tim made in India.
That's the RSC thing, right?
Yeah, it came to the RSC. It was very much our show. We created it in India, commissioned by the British Council, and it was made with a cast of performers drawn from across India, and it was performed in eight. It was Midsummer Night's Dream, but not as you and I might know it. It was performed in eight different Indian languages, including English, and it toured in outdoor theatres around India. And then was invited by the RSC to Stratford as part of their Complete Works Festival, and then came to the Roundhouse, and then went back to the RSC, and then toured nationally and toured internationally, went back to India. It was a big show, and it kind of like Warhorse and like these shows that are often trotted out as Matilda as being things that were slightly heavily subsidised and not very commercial, suddenly became a thing. But we don't really go out of our way to make shows that have commercial potential. The research process is so long. The regions that we work on, as I said, are geographically varied, that even bringing people together from across the world for a long period of time to rehearse is expensive. So sadly, when it comes through our prism, we're not making it kind of commercially viable. But possibly the idea is to keep the richness of that world, is not to make it one dimensional, to represent the different voices that come from that region in one show or in a number of shows.
The R&D department at Dash sounds like a fun place to work, though, right?
That's a great place to work.
Suitcase will travel, presumably, and a very sharp pencil at all times in order to write down your experiences. Where are you going next, and what do you hope to put into the next series of shows and projects that you're putting on?
We've not yet booked the next series of flights because we're just waiting for all the money to be in the bank. But the idea will be that at some point this year, I will be in Georgia, in the mountains, with 16 classically trained musicians no longer working, or very few of them still working in the classical music world, and my creative team. And the creative team in itself is a sort of a visa nightmare. I've got a Russian composer, a Ukrainian playwright, a Kazakh theatre director, and an Azerbaijani filmmaker, who are my creative.
So an Englishman, an Irishman, a Scotsman walking to a bar.
Exactly. And actually, it's sort of been really interesting working with them because I'm sort of leading it, but leading it through an interpreter because my French and my Russian is not good enough. And we have this common language of Russian, which is sort of politically challenging in many ways at the moment. But we're rehearsing in Georgia with all these musicians and the team at some point this year. That's one thing. And then similarly, my colleague Tim is working with a playwright, a Ukrainian playwright based in Moscow, to create on script development for his show 1917, which has been co-commissioned by the National Theatre here in London and the Perth International Festival and the Belgrade in Coventry and Lincoln Center in New York. So we have some big partners, but the research process is, as you say, it's wonderful and rich and very much about sitting in a cafe and just chatting to people, listening mainly.
That was my chat with Josephine Burton, one of the co-founders and artistic directors of Dash Arts. That's it.
That's the first one of the new year.
That was, I enjoyed that show, actually. It's good. But speaking to Joe Warwick, the man who edited the book about chefs, where chefs eat, man, that's made me hungry.
I want to have a look. I'm always very curious about your own city, because I always feel a sense of kind of shame, because you think, oh, I know my city quite well, and then you, I don't know that place. Where's that?
I'll tell you where I went. We went for a drink before it. We met a mutual friend of ours on Monday.
Yes.
Ciao Bella. On Lambs Conduit Street. That's a barrel of laughs. They're on the first Monday back of January. You think it's going to be the quietest? You think it's for a restaurant, that's a very down day, don't you? You think it's going to be very boring? Tell you what, that restaurant's a lot of fun.
They have a pianist. And what I live nearby. What I quite like is that it's proper, you know, Italian kind of style. They close down over Christmas and they get someone in to paint it. You always see there's a painter decorator in there that week over Christmas. And then they come back and it doesn't look that much change, but on their roll. And there's also the thing we've talked about before. There's, you know, some real kind of social equity. It's the same waiters year in, year out. And it's just great that people kind of, you know, what's great is they know you, but what's also great is they don't have to know you too much. They can be a bit rude because they know they're not going to get sacked. They know they're there forever.
Yeah.
They can be a bit kind of cheeky with it as well. It's a really, really great institution.
It is a good institution. Nice one. I loved all our guests. I thought Tom Edwards' news look ahead was subtle and amusing, just as it should be on a week like the one we've just had, Andrew. Yeah. Let's thank our team behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and Marcus Hippie, and our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We'll be here again next week, but from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Robert Bound.
It's goodbye, and thank you for listening.